Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn.
I'm Rosalind Brain, and I'm an assistant professor in sustainable communities, and I run a statewide environmental sustainability program educating the general public on ways that they can help reduce their environmental footprint.
Today on the program, Rosalind joins us to talk about how to do just that. Before she arrived at USU, Rosalind worked as a naturalist at Yellowstone National Park and in the Smoky Mountains. These experiences helped shape her commitment towards promoting more sustainable communities.
So when I was working as a naturalist in Yellowstone and especially in the Smoky Mountains, in teaching kids and adults about our ecosystem and the natural environment, I started to question whether or not there are ways that we can produce food and live in landscapes that function more like ecosystems. So ecosystems don't require us to water them. Natural ecosystems don't require any fertilizer inputs or other inputs. And so I started to think along those lines during that time. And what stemmed into that field of work for me before I moved here to Utah was going back to my work when I was a master's student in Canada. I'm actually from Canada, and I worked on the side as an agronomist assistant, and what that involved was when large-scale companies would come through and spray farmers' fields with pesticides, I'd walk through and see whether or not all the weeds had died from the spray and document which ones survived, etc. And on the side from that, I was working as well on a dairy farm and a large-scale broiler or chicken farm. And I just started to question our food production system and wondered if there were alternatives and different means in which we could produce food. And that stemmed into my master's research on public perceptions. I wanted to know what the public understood on the difference between organic and conventional agriculture. And so I was looking a lot into the communication of those terms and the registration of them in the public's eye. And then from there, I went to Florida to do my dissertation research, and I used predictive modeling to explain and predict which types of characteristics would influence farmers and ranchers to permanently preserve their land from development in a conservation easement program. My interest in that stemmed from coming from an agricultural community. And in Canada, we were surrounded by some heavily developed urban areas that were expanding out. Around us were Toronto, Niagara Falls, et cetera, and those were just coming closer and closer to our property. And so I became passionate about trying to preserve farmland. And then also from there, with my work in the parks and looking at ecosystem functions, I started to wonder, is there a way to find a field of work that helped preserve farmland but also helped educate people on alternative means of producing food? So that's where I'm at right now at Utah State.
I understand you toured commercial farms during your graduate research, and can you talk about your impressions of them and how they may have influenced your work today?
It was definitely an eye-opener for me, especially on the chicken farm. So during my master's, when I was researching public perceptions of organic and conventional agriculture, and on the side I was working as an agronomist assistant for a farmers cooperative in Ontario, Canada, and that involved when chemical companies would spray the farmers' fields, I would walk through and look and see which weeds were effectively dying off from the sprays and whether there was any resistance. And that really started to spark in my mind the question of whether or not there were alternative ways of producing food that weren't so intensive and hard on the land. And in addition, I worked at the time on a dairy farm and on a chicken farm. And both those environments, although they worked for producing food on a larger scale, it furthered that question in my mind of whether or not we could produce food in alternative means that were less stressful for the animals and also provided a good amount of food for people. And so once I graduated with my master's, I moved down to University of Florida, and I really wanted to look into, in addition to alternative means of producing food, whether or not there were effective programs and incentives for farmers and ranchers to permanently preserve their land in a sort of conservation easement. And so I conducted a statewide study with farmers and ranchers and used predictive modeling to look at the key characteristics and influences on farmer and rancher decisions to permanently preserve their land into a type of program like a conservation easement. So what are those main incentives they have to doing that? And then also, what types of ranchers and farmers were more likely to be interested in this type of program, and how do we reach out to those who aren't? And so ultimately, from that, my research was used by the Florida Farm Bureau and the Nature Conservancy to help them in their process of delivering conservation easement workshops. And so from that land preservation perspective and my background in agriculture, I then transitioned for a couple of years into working as a naturalist and in environmental education. And that provided a great foundation for me in looking at ecosystem functions. And then I was offered the position here at Utah State in August of 2011, and I started as a sustainable communities extension specialist. So my primary role with this job is to take university research and teaching and extend that out to the people across, especially throughout Utah. And it was great because I had full flexibility in what my program would look like when it came to sustainability. As a result of that, I was also receiving information on a myriad of topics. As you can probably imagine, sustainability, people would see my title and send me everything from cultural issues to renewable energy to local food issues, etc. And I decided it was really time for me to organize those into some main topic areas and hone down what I was going to focus on my public outreach into the key areas that I was being sent information on and what my background training was in. And so I launched an initiative called USU, so Utah State University Extension Sustainability.
And the word sustainability is used so much these days and in so many contexts. How do you define it?
How I define sustainability is that it's living an environmental ethic. And what that generally entails is just being mindful in our everyday behaviors of trying to have as minimal environmental impact as we can, and living in a way that hopefully improves our natural environment. The messaging that I use, I focus on positive messaging and positive communication, because I've found in working in this field, it's very easy to go down the path of our oceans are acidifying, our landfills are filling, and although those are all very important issues, I have found in the field of communications that people tend to gloss over when you focus on the negative side of sustainability. And instead, I've seen very positive results on transitioning into positive communication and message framing in a way that takes these very complex issues of sustainability, so our air quality issue in Utah, or renewable energy, which is a very complicated topic, but narrowing those down into easy steps that you could take in your everyday lives to help improve these bigger issues. And that's the path that I've taken in this initiative. And so, for example, with air quality, we have a fact sheet on biking as a mode of transportation. And that fact sheet provides people with some common barriers people have expressed when it comes to biking and ways to overcome those barriers. And then what are the benefits to biking? And although the ultimate goal of sustainability is to improve our natural environment, we communicate in a way that shows mainly the economic and the social benefits to doing environmental behaviors, because that's what people tend to grab onto the best. And so with biking, what's the amount of money you can save from riding your bike every day versus driving your car? And also, what are the social benefits? Can you maybe bike with a friend to work? And the health benefits, you can incorporate exercise and transportation into one thing and save time. And so those are the communication paths that we focus on when it comes to environmental sustainability. And when I say me, it's A lot of times I'll partner up with colleagues at USU who focus on different sustainability topics, or also I have grad students and undergraduate students who help me with my communication and outreach with environmental sustainability.
Community-supported agricultural farms have sprung up in Utah over the past decade in tandem with the sustainability movement. Rosalind explains the benefits.
I myself am a CSA member, and I believe in the system and think it's a great way to connect with a local producer closely and to experience the joys and the ups and downs of producing food. And so I'm a member with the USU Student Organic Farm. And what's great with that is I pick up my share right on campus once a week, which is helpful for me. And so when it comes to thinking about food miles, that has traveled a very short distance from production to sale. And it comes straight to my natural resources building, and the students manage the whole program. And I pick up my share and bike it home, and so have a very minimal impact when it comes to that. I've written a fact sheet on the local food movement, and I think the biggest benefit of buying locally, whether it's at a farmer's market or through a community-supported agriculture program, is you can see that farmer, you can talk to them face-to-face, you can, with a CSA share, you can say, wow, there's I haven't seen any garlic this year. Are you guys going to produce garlic? And if not, could we put that in next year's share? And so you're more actively involved, and I really enjoy that part of it. And it is, for a smaller scale producer, it provides a lot more job security to run a CSA program and have a farmer's market booth than to try and sell out to a larger market.
Can you describe your CSA share?
It varies week by week, and that's the beauty of a CSA share. But my half share, an example this week, I split my half share. So remember, this is a quarter share I'm talking about. And I still had 6 ears of corn and 2 beets and a bunch of mustard greens, kale, beans, and some garlic, sage, oregano, and just a broad, and that's just off the top of my head, and the most gorgeous orange heirloom tomato that you will ever see. That was part of my share this week. I was really excited about that. So,
I'm also a CSA member, and it definitely has increased my vegetable intake, and it's always a surprise each week.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, it is exciting, and what I love most about it is I don't function well on routine. I think every day my morning routine changes, and what's great about a CSA share is that it forces you to think outside your food safety zone or your food box, and you have no idea what you'll be getting that week in your share. And I love it. It's exciting. It's like Christmas morning every week when I receive that, because it totally changes from the week before. And there's usually at least one thing in there that, even though my background's in agriculture and I teach about local food movements, I generally find at least one product, maybe every other week, that I have no idea what it is and I have to figure out what to do with it. So it's really great.
But is it more expensive to get your organic vegetables from a CSA?
I would say it can be if you aren't wise in how you buy products. But at the farmer's market, I have not found a large price difference between general vegetables you can buy there versus in the grocery store. It's a very minor price difference. And for me, what I do pay more on, the benefits of that, of getting a beautiful heirloom tomato at the farmer's market versus what you generally find at the grocery store, there's no comparison in my mind of that.
And can you talk about the new program that's connecting local farmers with restaurants?
One program that we just launched last spring, so the spring of 2013, is Utah Farm Chef Fork. And this was a USDA grant that I received to connect producers with chefs across Utah. And in the spring, myself and a team of experts, including the director of Slow Food Utah and some professors from campus in agricultural communications and agricultural economics, we coordinated trainings for direct marketing to link producers with chefs, to train producers. If you were to go to a chef. Here are some best practices. So here's some general times that work well for restaurants. Here's how to practice a pitch. So what would you say to that restaurant, and how do you present your product to them? And then with chefs, it was just almost the flip side of that. So how do you reach out to local producers? How do producers prefer their payment schedule to be organized, et cetera? And those trainings were actually very successful. We had over 75 chefs and producers come out in the spring to three different trainings we offered in the Greater Salt Lake area. And from there, we were requested to do mingles, we've called them. And Slow Food Utah in the past has put on a mingle in the Salt Lake area. And what that is producers come out and set up just like they would at a farmer's market, except for they have smaller samples available. And then chefs within the time frame of the mingle will come through and sample products and talk to the producers and set up relationships. And so it's an informal environment. There's free food, there's free drinks. And we're doing those throughout the month of September. We're doing six mingles across the state, all the way from Moab up here to Logan. And those will be just informal environment. And our ultimate goal is to reduce food miles by providing opportunities for producers to connect with chefs. And there's advantages to chefs as well, that they can market that they are sourcing locally, that here are the farms that they're sourcing from and the products, and expand that list if they are already doing so.
What can listeners do directly to contribute to more sustainability efforts in their own communities?
One of the biggest things that when we talk about food that the general public could do to help improve this area is shop at your farmers market, support your local growers. If you're interested, join a CSA program. And also, there's a large power in going to the grocery store, and if you aren't seeing any featured items that are local, ask the manager or ask the produce manager, some staff members to get more local products, and say you want as a consumer to see more of this in the store. And that has a big impact on grocery store decisions of what they'll end up sourcing. And so be vocal about it. And also when you go to restaurants, ask, what do you guys have any featured items that are locally sourced? And just to consciously be aware of that and support restaurants that are sourcing locally.
How do you get people motivated to change their old habits and old behaviors and adopt these new ones? And also ones that might not always be as convenient.
Right now I'm mainly looking at message framing. And so what messages resonate best with people? What fosters people from thought to action? What makes that transition happen? And so what I found the biggest challenges are, and this generally can be overcome with taking the time to do your background homework before launching a new initiative, but looking at what do people see as barriers to something you're trying to propose, and how do we overcome those perceived barriers and maximize the benefits of what you're trying to do? And so when it comes to local food, what are perceived benefits people have? A lot of time people are worried that buying locally takes more effort, it costs more. These are common things that we see people have concerns over. But if you can relay that information of, if you buy locally, here is actually a direct cost comparison and it's not that much more expensive, and here's exactly where you can go to buy local food, and in addition to the Saturday market, and just make it as easy as possible for people to engage in those behaviors. And that's what I found to be the most successful.
Summer is nearly over, but it's not too late to get started. For more information about community-supported agriculture, visit csautah.org. Join us next week for part two of our Eat Your Way to a Smaller Footprint series, when Rosalind Brain discusses urban edibles and the permaculture movement. Sherry Quinn, Access Utah.
This is Tom Williams of Utah Public Radio. Tuesday evening, September 17th, from 5 to 10 o'clock, a generous Logan restaurant will donate 20% of its sales to UPR. You can dine on your own between 5 and 10 p.m. or meet and eat with me and my UPR colleagues from 6 to 8 o'clock. A special menu that includes fettuccine alfredo, ribeye steak, or grilled salmon is available. I look forward to meeting you. Complete details and reservations are at upr.org. That's upr.org. Thank you.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the College of Science at Utah State University, where graduates' acceptance rates to medical, dental, and graduate schools exceed national averages. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information at usu.edu/science.
Driving down the road this morning, I'm feeling a sense of freedom. Looking back.
Welcome to Science Questions. This is Sherry Quinn.
How I traveled so far. I had my share of bad luck. It only made me strong.
Covelo is a small mountain town located in Round Valley, Northern California, with a population of about 3,000 people. Driving into the valley, it looks much like entering Cache Valley, Utah, from the mouth of Sardine Canyon. Agricultural fields line the highway, and forested mountains border the lush valley. Only Round Valley is surrounded by the Eel River and the Mendocino National Forest. The Yaqui were the first inhabitants of Round Valley, and in the late 1800s, six different tribes were forced onto the newly established Yaqui Indian Reservation. The Yaqui, in turn, were forced to share their ancestral homeland with strangers and enemies, and fighting ensued. After years of intermarriage and land sharing, they banded together and formed a new tribe in 1936, called the Round Valley Indian Tribe. It is the largest Indian reservation in California. Today, the town of Covelo is a community of farmers. In Chapter 1 of our series, Farm Action, we profile the 30-year-old horse-powered CSA farm, Live Power, founded by Stephen and Gloria Decatur. It is one of the first community-supported agricultural farms in the U.S. to use biodynamic practices, which means they apply a spiritual, ethical, ecological approach to agriculture.
I mean, these are just beautiful.
Yeah, that one's called Beatrice, and it's a really wonderful purple, lavender, purple, kind of violet,
I guess you'd call
that. He
is describing one of the eggplant varieties
sort of
he has harvested.
Shaded, darker in some areas and lighter in others. And yeah, it's quite beautiful. It's a little bit of a shy producer, but it's worth it because it's really beautiful and I think tastes pretty good, too, so.
Hey, good morning.
I never see Keegan smile that big in the morning.
Sylvia is one of seven apprentices at the farm. Each year, 4 to 7 apprentices come here from across the nation and the world to learn how to develop their own small-scale organic farms.
I'm picking parsley, and I'm picking it from the outside in so the inside can keep growing. And I'm not counting, though I should be. I'll count later. And I'm picking off the yellow leaves and throwing them in the path. We're going to give them to the cows.
And how many do you have to pick?
500 and something, depending on how many members we have today. So it's like 5 per share.
Live Power Farm supports 200 members or households in San Francisco and Mendocino counties. Once a week, they receive an overflowing basket of fresh organic vegetables, which feeds upwards of 600 people from just 40 acres.
I'm kind of like the go-to greens person. Everyone else has a thing that they harvest every day. Like Amy does carrots, and Keegan does eggplant, Alex does basil. I had kale, but then we stopped having kale, so now I have any other green that comes up. Carrots are also a little bit of a hassle. They all have their own quirks, at least the way we do it here, you know. because, like, we're just harvesting it for the CSA.
We are standing in the 4-acre garden among raised beds and row crops filled with eggplants, corn, melons, peppers, tomatoes, and more. Much more. Stephen has the spacing of each plant and row perfected to maximize healthy growth and productivity. The seeds were started from their homemade soil with the help of 6 draft horses, and they generate their own garden fertility with their compost and cover crops. They also produce their own hay and grain and use intensive rotational grazing for their horses, cattle, and sheep. A flock of chickens, a dairy cow, and feeder pigs complete the farm organism.
We grow what there's like 8 probably or more different varieties of eggplant in these 4 beds. And everything from the early Japanese slender, long ones to these globe type and Italian types. It just, you know, our goal being 100% community-based farm, we don't go to markets with produce at all. We work directly with a community of about 200 households that we're feeding, and we're trying to grow the vegetable supply for those people, and we want it to have diversity, and we want to spread any given crop over as long of a season as it's possible to grow that crop over, so that we can keep having a good diversity in the baskets that people get.
How many do you have to harvest today?
5. We're trying to get 4 per share.
This is Sarah, the garden manager, harvesting this week's corn crop.
We just about have it, but we're trying to get about 50 more. Keegan, do you have your number?
41.
Okay, cool.
Why did you get into this field?
Well, I had been farming in Colorado and Nebraska and had heard about this place from people out there who were surprised that I didn't know about it, seeing as though I grew up in the Bay Area. And this is one of the first CSAs in California, and they use draft horses, and I had been working on biodynamic farms as well. So the folks that told me about this place, that's why they were surprised I didn't know about it, because there are not many CSA farms that use draft horses. In California, at least, biodynamic CSA farms that use draft horses. So I came back for Thanksgiving to visit family and drove up from the Bay that weekend to help Steve and Gloria with their final harvest, and really enjoyed myself and got along well with Steve and Gloria kind of right off the bat. So, and this is a gorgeous valley. Similar enough to where I grew up, or at least familiar in certain ways, but also a lot more wild and open and peaceful and calm. And so I was definitely attracted to the beauty of this farm and of this valley and of the people who work here. And I was looking also for a place that had some traditions already set and a more formal apprenticeship program, and that's what I found here, and it's been great.
What inspires you about this work and this philosophy, and what's the value in it that you see and hope to show others?
Well, I guess what really draws me to farming, a lot of things draw me to farming, but why I know this is something that I want to do for the rest of my life, and what continues to inspire me, is that I will never fully understand how plants grow and how every ecosystem works. There's something really amazing and intriguing and enigmatic about it, and the fact that I'll be learning for the rest of my life is really exciting. And I also, just at a very basic level, love growing food for people. Mm-hmm. So I feel like being a farmer and doing it in a responsible way brings a lot of light into the world, and we're living in a time when it's
difficult to determine how your actions affect things, you know, in a positive and a negative way, whether or not you're contributing to some greater good, or there's a lot of kind of overwhelming things happening right now. So farming is very grounding and it's very real. And at the end of the day, if you're trying your best to be responsible about it, you know, then I feel like I'm doing something positive and there is light that I'm bringing into the world. So that's what inspires me. And I work with some amazing people, so that's inspiring as well.
Now the melons are starting to ripen, so that's the next kind of big harvest that we're headed into. But everything else is still, all the summer crops are still producing pretty heavily. We had lots of cucumbers and summer squash last week. Actually filled the cargo van almost so full that I was going to wonder where to put the boxes. And that went all to San Francisco.
That must be a good filling.
Yeah, it is good. Always exciting to have a really bountiful harvest, you know, and to get to this time of year, which is the harvest time. In the early spring, you don't have anything, really. And you're just starting planting your crops in March and getting things in the ground and a lot of work to get everything going so that then you are going to have a crop. And then the early spring crops come in. But then you've got to start getting all the summer crops in and while you're harvesting the spring crops. And then all the weeds start trying to come into it. And so there's a lot of weeding and cultivation. And then this time of year now, the harvest is going to start to take more and more of our time. We try to get all this harvesting done before 9, before it heats up, get it out of the field, get it in where it can stay cool. And that way it keeps the best. Get everything in good condition, the best condition that we can.
What about insects?
Well, you know, insects always come when there's an unhealthy condition, really, and they come to eliminate the plants that aren't growing as strongly or are as healthy. So if you can try to build your overall fertility so you have a really good soil fertility, and it's a balanced fertility, it's not like stimulated by a lot of fast-release, even organic fertilizers, you'll get big growth and everything, but you will unbalance the plant a little and you will have more insect problems. So for us, we, you know, do a lot of cover cropping on the soil, and we also create all of our compost out of this farm. So the materials, the manure from our livestock and the straw from fields, like a grain field will make straw or old hay, and then all of the green weed material, or if we have a clover or something, we can cut and put in the compost, or a cover crop we can cut and put in the compost. Those three things, the manure, the straw, and the green material in thin layers and with about 10% soil. And we can create a really good compost. And then we use the biodynamic compost preparations, which there are 5, oak bark, dandelion, chamomile, yarrow, stinging nettle, valerian. And we insert those in the compost pile as it's reaching maturity or, you know, starting to go into the fermentation. And those preparations help guide that whole breakdown of material in a real optimum way, that then it's already prepared and in a good balance and in a living state to go back into the soil as compost. So we generate about 40 or 50 tons of compost each year here. And we don't buy compost off the farm. I mean, it's actually a huge carbon footprint loss or release of carbon if you buy your compost from outside sources and all the material has been hauled in to make the compost. That's a big, you know, pollution energy footprint. And then you know, it has to be turned mechanically, and then it's got to be loaded in a truck and taken back out to the farm, and that results in a really big carbon footprint for that farm. So we're trying to avoid that and create the compost right in the farm organism, and then it's just used right in the farm organism, so it's not being hauled. And we have better compost. We know what the material is that we've put in, and I think that that results in a better soil fertility, and that helps with the whole insect problem. So it's all connected. The farm is an organism. It's a living being in a way, and it needs all of its parts. If it just has nothing but vegetables and no livestock, or it just has nothing but livestock and no forage or plant material, then it's already starting in an unbalanced state. I mean, nature has the whole realm, you know, of plants and animals, and they're actually working together. And it's a subtle relationships and mutual support, but ultimately it makes really a big difference to the health of the whole organism to create your inputs out of your farm. And that's, you know, a biodynamic principle, and we are a biodynamic farm, Demeter certified since 1986, actually.
Demeter certification is a base set of standards that form a common legal foundation and agricultural framework for biodynamic practice worldwide.
So one of the basic principles of biodynamic farming is to try to create all that's needed for the farm out of the farm organism itself. So that's our goal. It's not always easy to achieve.
What are the challenges that you have to face?
Well, it's a lot of work to get all of that done. You know, like two or three mornings of the week, we have to go in the corral, pick up the manure from the animals that they leave overnight, and, you know, take it and build the compost. And there's just a lot to do, and so it's not that it's hard particularly to do, it's just that you really have to be aware of the timing and that you have a limited window. Everything has its time and its place in the order of things, and if you can stay abreast of that, then you can do a really good job. And if you don't respond and let stuff start slipping by, then it kind of avalanches and your weeds will take over your crops, and then you lose all the work that you've put in the first place to get the things raised and planted and started. And so it's the timing is really critical, and observation and being able to see what's coming. You know, you're always planning 6 months ahead of where you are, really. Like we're planting a lot of the fall crops actually are already planted now. You know, you can't just get one part planted and then sort of take a nap.
Oh, I thought there was a break in there somewhere.
Yeah, maybe a little bit in the winter, the days are a lot shorter. And but during the growing season, you know, there's a adage, make hay when the sun shines. Well, that's because the hay has to get dried, and, you know, it'll get damaged if it's rained on and everything. But it isn't just hay that is a crop that's sensitive to timing and to what's going on with nature, and it's really the same for everything. So, you know, you got to plant things when it's time, and you've got to weed when it's time, and you've got to harvest when it's time, or you're going to be off the track and not have very good results.
This climate and ecosystem just seems particularly suitable for farming and mm-hmm. Northern California, this region, and mm-hmm. I think of Utah and where it's so dry. And mm-hmm. what recommendations do you have for climates like that and to do this?
Yeah, well, vegetable growing in particular is a very water-intensive endeavor. There's just really no way around it. So I guess that means that you want to try to set aside some of the areas where there's good soil and where there is water, because those are the areas that are going to be critical for food production. And when we can't load it all in a truck and drive it 1,000 miles, it's going to be critical to have that ability. So those are probably the areas that are most attractive that people want to move into and live on. But really, we've got to, I think, preserve places where there's good soil and where there's good water. You know, people have succeeded. There's a story about, it's called The Man Who Planted Trees. It was in France, I believe, and it was an area that had been logged and destroyed more or less and was without water. And this guy spent a good part of his life just going through and planting chestnut trees and reforesting areas. And after a while, there started to be actually more water in springs coming back, you know. So that would be a good public works project for the government. You know, spend some money there instead of blowing up places. And
the fracking, you know? Right? And all the fracking that's going on.
Oh, yeah.
Covering that
the road. Water that's used for that is incredible volumes of water.
Right.
And then it gets polluted in the process. And so, I mean, it's the whole thing of a short-term win economically, a short-term win, and a long-term disaster. And my belief is that we will never really have sustainable agriculture until we have a sustainable economic process. And the market economic process based on gain for individual parties just is short-sighted in the end and will only lead to more and more conflict. And we need to change the economic process into an associative economic process where all the parties that are involved, their needs are looked at. And so in farming, that's going to be the earth, the farmer, and the eaters. Those are all players. And we have to look at those needs and then base the economics off of that, meeting those needs. Then we have a sustainable economic system. And the bottom line is meeting the common good, not meeting individual profit. And that's where we got to go, because the population, human population, just increases. The Earth's resources are finite. Survival in the future is going to be survival of the whole community, of all of us, not just individual factions. And so we could do that. This farm is specifically, we have chosen not to engage in the conventional market process. We don't sell food in any farmers' markets. We don't sell food to retail or wholesale. We work directly with a community of members, of people that know the farm and are willing to defray the operating costs and share a little bit of the risk of the season. So far, there's never been a food failure of any extent that people would end up having to go hungry, except maybe a couple of times with late spring frosts in the spring that have delayed the ripening and the planting and then subsequent harvest. There are storage crops that you can bridge some of those less fruitful times with. You know, we've kept potatoes and onions clear through March, and cabbage, and some of the kale and chard and some of those kinds of greens that are almost biennial that you can stretch through a couple of seasons, you can still harvest food from. So, you know, the members do share a little bit in risk, but really, we're all going to share in the risks of life.
Stephen says they have not had any severe shortages in the 23 years they have been supplying food.
It's been a pretty bountiful food supply. But this plant has too many fruits.
The clean, pine-like scent of parsley permeates my nostrils as I kneel down to talk to Sylvia from Canada. She hopes to start her own small organic farm and does not mind the hard work. They work from dawn until 7 p.m. Monday through Friday and half a day on Saturday. She sees the value in this kind of farm work.
I think that it's showing a way of being that is sustainable in a lot of different ways. I like the economic model that they have, and I like the way that we use our own farm to produce the fertility that we need for the garden. I think that's important. And a lot of organic places just buy compost. That might be me. I might do that in the future, but I want to know how to make my own. It's a lot of work, but I think it's worth it. I think it's nice to have the kids come to the farm, too.
It is around 9 in the morning, and Sarah and Keegan are nearly finished with the corn harvest. It's breakfast time, and they're anxious to finish and make their way to the communal kitchen. And so you must eat really well here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a perk I should have mentioned.
What are your meals like?
Oh, they're amazing. Honestly, every meal is fantastic, and we cook for one another. We have a big enough farm crew here that we trade off preparing lunch and dinner for each other, and breakfast as well. It's a little bit less formal, but yeah, we all cook for each other, and it's a great gift. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone really enjoys preparing meals for their coworkers, so that when the rest of us come in hungry and tired, there's a really amazing meal waiting for us. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't think people would work as hard as they do here if the food weren't so good, because that's a big part of our compensation.
Yeah.
So everyone who works here, that's something that they really value in their lives, is good food and
a healthy diet, right?
When we go out to the sort in Mendocino, or when there are a couple times we went to San Francisco together, and people always comment on how healthy we look. I mean, we think we look pretty dirty because, you know, we have permadirt all in our hands. But, yeah, people usually comment on how vibrant we look. And, it, you know, it's the lifestyle, it's the food.
Mind if I record your kitchen sounds for a few minutes?
No,
that's what it's all about, right?
They want beans, I'm warming up some. Sure, I'll try it.
Yeah. Utah has its own growing CSA community. There are about 35, and a few of them practice biodynamic principles. More information is available at csautah.org.
Oh, ain't it funny how the grapevine turns into red wine? Ain't it funny how the red wine tickles my mind?
Next week on SQ Radio, we continue our series, Farm Action, and explore the unique economic system and land ownership principles inspired by Live Power Farm in Kovalo. Special thanks to Mario for providing the music from the album 100% Kovalo Cali Made, Volume 1. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Susie Montgomery, and Elaine Taylor. Thank you for listening.
'Cause I drank red wine all night. Oh yes, I had a little party last night. A private little party with some bottles of wine. I was dancing alone, staring at the phone, drinking red wine all night. Oh yes, I really had a party last night. Dancing with the shadow and the candlelight. Oh, love had flown, left me alone. So I drank red wine all night. Well, I was hoping I would hear the phone, telling me she's coming home, telling me she's sorry that she left me alone. Well, now I'm running out of moonlight, looking at daylight, 'cause I drank red wine all night. Yes, I had a little party last night.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn about the Utah artist considered to be among the top women American artists, teacher, dancer, rancher, and tenacious painter, Minerva Tykert. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
Artist Minerva Kohlhepp Tykert was born in North Ogden, Utah in 1888. Throughout her life, she captured on canvas the great Mormon pioneer story and the story of the American West. Minerva grew up in a large family on a remote ranch in Idaho. Her mother was the daughter of one of Brigham Young's bodyguards, and her father had been disowned by his prominent family when he joined the LDS Church. The religious and pioneer stories told by her parents inspired Minerva's art all her life. Though women artists were not common in the West during this time, there is no doubt that the young Minerva got an early start to her career. When she was 4 years old, her mother gave her a set of watercolors, and from then on, Minerva considered herself an artist. She carried sketch pad and charcoal with her constantly, a practice she maintained into adulthood. As a young woman, Minerva taught school to save money to attend the Art Institute of Chicago, and was the first woman to be sent for art lessons with the official blessing of the LDS Church. She later received a scholarship to study at the Art Students League in New York City, one of the most important art centers in the world. To pay her way, she sketched cadavers for medical schools, illustrated children's books, painted portraits, and performed rope tricks and Indian dances on the New York stage. Minerva turned down opportunities to further her career in the East and instead returned home to paint the history of the Mormon people. She married cowboy Herman Tykert and with him ran their ranch and raised their five children. Somehow, she also painted. Her studio was their living room, which was too small for her large works, so she folded her murals as she painted and, to get the correct perspective, viewed her canvases through the wrong end of a pair of binoculars. Her children were sent to bed at 8 o'clock each night so she could paint until midnight. Tykert produced prolifically, painting more pioneer and Indian subjects than any other Utah artist. Women and Western themes feature prominently in her work, and she is noted for a series of murals depicting the scenes from the Book of Mormon. Her aim was to produce works of art that would motivate people, in her words, to build Zion. She created more than 60 murals that adorn public places in Utah, and her work is in museum collections throughout the state. Minerva Tykert died in 1976 in Provo, Utah. Content for this episode of the Beehive Archive was provided by the Springville Museum of Art. Sources and past episode of the Beehive Archive may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.